Hi, this is Danielle from the Jaws Curator, and this is episode 106, also known as the first episode in season 2 of Art for Your Ear. Yay! Yes, I am so happy to be back after taking a summer hiatus. Now, in case you're wondering, what was I doing for 3 months? There was a lot of art making, book writing, hanging out at the beach with my family, a trip to Toronto to hang a Tragically Hip-inspired art show, and finally 2 magical weeks spent in Venice, Italy, teaching and studenting at the European Cultural Academy. I ate all of the pasta and Italy's entire supply of watermelon gelato. It was a busy hiatus, but insanely inspiring and just the recharge I needed. And so now, here we are, September, season 2, a whole bunch of new interviews with talented, successful artists who also happen to be regular people with great stories. Now, this podcast would not be back for season 2 without the help of sponsors. So let me begin by saying this episode is supported by Saatchi Art, the world's largest curated online gallery offering original art by independent artists from around the world. Please visit their gorgeous roster at saatchiart.com. And while we're talking about wonderful, generous sponsors, if your company is interested in co-sponsoring Art for Your Ear, I'm all ears. Yeah, I'm sorry, I seriously made that joke. All right, let's get on with today's guest, shall we? Ghostly dresses, strange animals, delicate faces. Can you guess which painter I'm talking to? Yes, it is the incredibly talented, German-born, US-based artist Anne Seams. I was so excited to finally, quote unquote, meet her and thrilled to have another excuse to post a bunch of her gorgeous work. Now, 2 quick disclaimers. We recorded this at the end of August, beginning of September, and both of us were surrounded in forest fire smoke. So there was a tiny bit of coughing. And about halfway through, there's a weird noise in the background that sounds a lot like a shower. Because it was a shower. You will know this for sure when you hear Anne's teenage daughter start singing at the top of her lungs. Hilarious. Okay, so disclaimers complete. Here we go, chatting with Anne Seams in Seattle. Hi, Anne.
Hi.
I am so excited. You're my first interview back for season 2.
Great.
It's
going to
be
honored.
I have, I you know what, I say this, I used to say this all through season 1, and here I go again. I have loved your work for years. I've written about you a few times. I was going to do it again, and I thought, no, I'm going to see if she'll come and talk to me on the podcast. And you
Absolutely.
Said yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and,
I find that.
Well, I was going to
say, go ahead.
I love that you, can I say that you have string in your hands right now?
Yes.
I love that. Before we started, you had to go and get a piece of string. Tell us why.
Because I just really can concentrate better and feel more rested when I just have something in my hands to do. And then also, I have to say, I love doing craft so much, but I never have enough time because I always have to get to another show. And, you know, before we chatted, I was just working on a fox that I'm painting, and then when we're done I have to get immediately back out because I have a show in Nashville coming up.
Yeah.
And I don't really have a ton of time for it, so those sort of little projects that, you know, just are around my house, like I'm knitting, and right now I'm making a dream catcher, and I want to do some leather work to put a little leather band around this hat that I got at a thrift store. And so, you know, it's like these are all these little sort of fiddle projects that I just love doing. And the dream catcher is for a friend of mine who's opening her first store in my neighborhood. And, you know, she has all these beautiful handmade things and recycled things. And I just thought this will be a beautiful little piece for her store. So
is that what you're fiddling with right now?
Yeah, that's what I'm fiddling with.
Oh, I love it. That is the best. Well, good for you, because I can barely like walk and chew gum at the same time. So that's very inspiring. You know, it's so interesting. I'm totally veering off the path. Well, you know what? I'm going to veer back. I just think it's so interesting that you love craft and your work has that element to it. You know, it almost feels like there could be embroidery in there, or mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. so have yeah. you always been like that? Have you always sort of been crafty? Did you grow up in a crafty family?
No, actually, well, yes and no. So my dad is really the one that's responsible for my interest in art. He is an elementary art teacher, and he's always supported our art making by simply usually just giving stuff to us. You know, just he's never been one to be very, which is surprising, not very didactic, you know, not the one to say, oh, well, but look, if you drew the tree like that, then it would look. No, he would just give us like ample stuff to do. And we never had like, we never had those books to, what are they called? Well, you fill in the color.
Coloring books.
Coloring books. I can't think of the name. But it was always like huge sheets of paper that he would roll out on the carpet and have huge brushes. Or when we lived in Argentina for a short amount of time, and when we lived there, we had these large garage windows, and he got paint for us to work on, to just paint the garage windows and things
wow.
like that. You know? So just always kind of just big stuff, you know, that we could play with.
Yeah. And, oh, that's so great.
Yeah. So I think that was a really good move, you know, to just like really not be very intrusive to what we were doing, but always just ask like, you know, just here, have this material, use this material, just to play with stuff.
Well, that's the cool thing, right, with kids, is that you put it in front of them and they don't need instruction.
Yeah.
Adults seem to need instruction, but kids will just do it.
Yeah, exactly.
So before Argentina, so you were born in Germany.
Yeah.
And so how old were you guys when you moved to Argentina?
I turned 4 on the ship, and it was a big freight ship that only had a very limited number of passengers it took along. So all our furniture and our car and everything was on this ship with us. And we went via Rio de Janeiro and then down to Buenos Aires. And I got roller skates on the ship. There are photos of me in the hallways holding on to the banister. You know,
yeah.
Always have banisters for high, you know, in case of high seas. And,
or in case of roller skates.
Skates, exactly. And and I also remember that I encountered my first Barbie dolls on that ship. I just have really strong memories of that. Even though, I mean, with 4, you know, you think there isn't so much memory, and I have pictures of me with the roller skates, but there's certainly no pictures of me playing with Barbies. But there was this rich family from, I can't remember if they were Americans or Brazilians, but I befriended them, and they had these most magical dolls. So that would have been like, let's see, 1969. Yeah, I should do some research. I can't remember when the first Barbie came out.
It must have been around then.
Yeah. It could have been spin-offs, but I don't think they had spin-offs of Barbies back then. But anyway,
listening to this is going to be a Barbie expert, and they're going to comment and say, actually, it was 1942, and blah, blah, blah. And so why were you guys going to Argentina?
Well, my dad had an offer to work there as a teacher in a German-Spanish-speaking school. And back then, there were these great offers for German teachers to go either to Iran or to South America for either 3 or 5 years, respectively. And kind of that we ended up in Argentina was just a fluke, and that my parents only wanted to go for a 3-year stint. And so because of that, that was the only choice they had. And so we ended up there, and my dad taught I think all levels from elementary to, the last year of high school, and he taught German and art and PE.
Wow. And so did you start school there?
I did. Yeah, I did. And I, back then, was fluent in Spanish, and I have little notebooks to prove it. And because we had to do, it's weird, but we had to do so much writing in first grade. I mean, when I look at that now, it just seems, you know, school is luckily not like that anymore, but we had like long, I have pages of stories, you know, that,
wow.
that I wrote then and that I always edit. My little books were always full of little paintings and drawings that accompanied everything in that little book, which is really fun for me to look at now. And
were there little animals in there too?
Probably.
Yeah.
Mostly people, though. I've always been someone, I've always painted people. That was my main thing. Like, I could never figure out how to paint a bicycle or something, but people, and mostly women, because they're just so much more interesting to paint, I think.
That was one of my questions for you. Yeah, because that's one thing. I have a major thing for portraits of women.
Mm-hmm.
Which is probably a huge reason that I love you. I also, of course, love Squirrel Boy. That's one of my favorite paintings of yours. what's the draw to women? Is it just you just like painting their features and things like that?
Yeah, I think it's. I don't know. I really like painting boys too, and obviously younger girls as well. But I think part of it is too that there's something autobiographical in it that I can relate to, that I feel I can't paint if it's a guy. You know, I've painted a few men in my works, but it just doesn't feel like as genuine, or I don't even really think about it. You know, it's just like I just want to paint, you know, and often I sort of have a little stash of images that are sort of my muses that I paint over and over, and I just go back to them, and every time I paint them, they change a little bit.
Are they found photos, or what are they?
They're mostly from old masters that that I kind of just collect through either Pinterest or, you know, through someone who posts something on Instagram or something. I like the face or find it interesting. But then I end up usually just going back to the same face. Sometimes I need to look at somebody who's a little bit in a different position. And sometimes I ask my daughter to just model just so I can get the position of the eyes and the hands or something like that. She's especially helped me when I need sort of hand poses or holding poses. You know,
hands are weird when you actually try and paint them.
Hands are the worst thing. I've luckily seen that various masters have exclaimed that there's nothing more difficult to paint than hands, and I would attest to that. It's so, so difficult. And I've been wanting to take, there's one woman that teaches here at an art academy that had a class on painting hands and feet, and I could not take that class at the time she was teaching it, and I'm just keeping my eyes peeled on her teaching again.
Yeah.
I think that would help so much to just have some, I mean, because all my work really is self-taught. I went to an art school in Berlin.
I was gonna go back to the chronological. Okay, so wait, we'll loop back around to this. So you're in Argentina. Okay. You guys go back to Germany.
Yeah.
And then, so did you always think that you probably would go to art school?
Did you go to art school? Yeah, I did go to art school, but I don't think I was really spending any thought about it until I was in what we call high school. You know, it's called Gymnasium, which is where you'd get your BA, you know, sort of a, you know, it's a different system in Germany. So you get almost like what would be here, like, it's sort of in between it's probably like 2-year college kind of.
Okay.
In Britain it's called A levels, in French it's called the baccalauréat. So people can do it here too now, called the international baccalauréat, IB. I don't know if you guys.
Yeah, my sister actually went to an American school in Belgium.
Oh, okay.
And they had those classes that she could do. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think sometime then in those years, I was like, I had some other friends who had applied, and so I made my portfolio, and I was really lucky because I got in, and they out of many, many applicants, they really don't take that many because it's a state school. There are no private schools. And, you know, space is limited. So, and also being able to get, I didn't apply to any others in any other states. I only applied for the one in Berlin. I don't know. Maybe a little cocky. It didn't even occur to me that maybe I won't get in. I mean, I don't know. But I did get in. But then I have to say I was pretty quickly disappointed. You have like a half a year where you work in sort of a group classroom, which that year was really fun, and you get to try out some different things. You do a little sculpture and you do a little this and that. But then I kind of really didn't know to what teacher to go to. You know, you sort of have to become kind of like a master pupil.
Okay.
To one teacher, and there really isn't much room to, you know, go for critique to someone else, which I think, why wouldn't you want to get more feedback than one person? And so I ended up in the class of a guy whose work at the time I really didn't like. I have to say, in hindsight, now I really love his work. I think he's amazing. But at the time, I kind of just, that wasn't what I was into. His work is sort of neo-expressionist and it's pretty wild and raw, and it's really fabulous. His name is Wolfgang Patrick. Back then I was really into Howard Hodgkin a lot, but I was really then into David Hockney and sort of very sort of pop art-ish, you know, pastel colored California sun drenched images.
And, wow.
You know, and just really, really different work. And I just kind of just didn't fit in with this classroom that had all these angst-ridden images and darkness and crusty paint. And so I ended up then actually leaving the studio there, the studio space, because I just didn't feel comfortable there. You know, I think I felt that I really couldn't do there what I wanted to do. I felt too much like someone's looking over my shoulder and going, what is that, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's how I felt in art school, too.
Yeah. And it's really, I mean, it's kind of interesting to me now that I just kind of, I think intuitively it was a good idea. I just painted at home, and then every once in a while I would see my art teacher, but that, of course, made it that he really didn't have much contact with me. Also, I don't think he liked me or liked what I painted. You know, a little bit, there's this whole real male-oriented macho thing. There were, you know, I think the students he liked the most painted like him. Mm. And if they were women, they had to adore him or maybe go to bed with him. And, you know, like, those were the ones that were supported, and the rest were like, well, whatever. I may make time for a critique with you, but I may also not. And I mean, it was just such a crappy energy there, especially back then. I mean, finally, they have some women there at the art school, too, but it was just not good. And but I think what it taught me is to just be really self-sufficient and independent, and I just painted away, and art school gave me sort of the legitimation, is that a word? The legitimacy?
There we go. Yeah, I was like, that's close. I can't think what it is. Yep.
to you know, to pursue that and to just keep working. And I just kind of did my thing all on my own. And in that sense, I do feel also, because there weren't any formal classes. You didn't learn how to work with egg tempera or pastels, or there was never sort of like a, you know, painting 101 class or something. You know, when I was an exchange student, I actually had a class like that. So then I was like, aha, you can also do this, and you can work with this material, and, you know, which was really fun.
Where did you do the exchange?
I did it at a tiny, tiny college in the mountains of Tennessee called the University of the South at Suwannee. I was really just one out of two serious studio students, and the rest of the students just took it as, you know, one of the classes to take. But I had a wonderful art teacher there, Tom Fellner, who is now living back in Switzerland. But he was super fun, and it was just a great time studying there and really having, you know, real, you know, like someone who's really interested in what I'm doing and getting some support there. But then, you know, I had to go back to Germany, and I finished my school there, and I actually ended up being very happy in my last year there. I have to add that I fell through one of the exams, and it was partly the fact that, you know, that I didn't have a support in my teachers. So they kind of, in a certain way, they had to let some students not get through the exam just to keep sort of a certain profile at school, you know, that not everybody gets to get through, you know. And then I could repeat it a year later. And so then I repeated it. But by that time, they finally had a female professor there. And I absolutely, absolutely loved her. She's from Japan. And I totally just kind of really, you know, changed what I was doing and worked just on paper and really simplified things and just created a whole different type of work than what I was doing before.
Wow. Is it closer to what you're doing now, or was that totally different too?
It's very different. Yeah. It was, excuse me, my lungs are affected by the smoke that we have
here. I know, so much smoke on our coast over here.
So I apologize to your listeners.
We'll give them I'll give them a little smoke debrief at the beginning so they understand.
Yeah, that's good. And then, so I was really, really happy that I got to switch to her and just felt that I had someone who had my back. So what I was doing just in a nutshell was kind of working just with paper, wax, graphite, Conte crayon, and I was doing these very large, mostly room installations of sort of abstract biological patterns. So they both had a look of DNA, but also of insects, spiders, very gestures. Yeah, it was really different, but it was kind of then a segue to my work once I moved to the States in 1991, where I worked on painting sort of biological shapes that had the look of you know, where it started to look more like medieval illuminations, you know.
Oh, so yeah, yeah.
Became more precise, but they were still forms that were organic, where it wasn't clear, is this a plant, is this an organ? I added the sort of fake Latin text to it, and they really looked like old manuscripts. They were done on paper that I had waxed and then worked on with ink and acrylic, and they were really beautiful. Those were my first pieces that I had an art show with here in Seattle in 1992, I believe, and that was kind of the wonderful beginning of my art career here.
Wow.
In Seattle.
Okay, I have follow-up questions.
All right.
A, why did you decide to come to the States, and why Seattle?
Okay, so when I was done at my studies at the University of the South, I had planned an internship at a gallery in Atlanta, and there I met my first husband, who's also an artist. He's a sculptor, and his name is David French. I think you might like his work. You should check it out.
Okay.
And we wanted to stay together, so he said, well, I'll just follow you to Germany, and he did, and kind of learned a little German and did some odd jobs. And, you know, one of the reasons why we did get married as young as we did was that otherwise he couldn't have stayed. You know, he needed a work visa or a green card.
Yeah.
And when I was done with my studies, we had known all along that we wanted to live in the States again. And honestly, we really didn't know a thing about Seattle. We knew some people that lived here that were friends of his brother. So we kind of had like a first place where we could land.
Mm-hmm.
And we were kind of like, well, New York is so big, it's so hard to make it there as an artist. Excuse me, I've got to drink something. And then we thought, well, San Francisco, earthquakes, let's not go there. Ha, ha, ha. This is how much we knew about Seattle, right? So we ended up in Seattle, which, seriously, my mom was like, do you guys have to go to the farthest coast of America? You know, why couldn't you have been on the East Coast? Which, like, in hindsight, I agree. It would have been much easier to connect, you know?
Yeah, yeah, that's a long flight, I know.
nevertheless, Seattle was just the perfect place. It seems like we were meant to be here. Within a week, we found an apartment, and just before we found the apartment, we had like a rental car for like a week, you know, while we were searching, and we were sitting on a bench overlooking the Puget Sound and seeing the Olympics, and we were like, oh God, wouldn't it be great to have, you know, a place here nearby. And lo and behold, 5 minutes later, we're driving down the hill a little ways, and there's this great apartment with an epic view, like almost like 180 degrees of just Puget Sound and mountains. And back then, rent was really cheap here. And, you know, we had like a bedroom and sort of a living dining room situation. And so we just each had one of the rooms as our studio.
Wow.
And ate in the kitchen, you know, and it was perfect. And it had a little yard, and yeah, it was,
wow.
It was incredible that we would get a place that was so inspiring. That was really,
yeah, very picture perfect Seattle. It's what you would think of for Seattle.
Yeah.
And so, did you go there thinking that you would be a full-time artist, or were you going to get odd jobs and make art on the side, or what happened once you got there?
It was funny. I was actually pretty burned out with the whole art scene, and I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm just going to try and find a job. I mean, now in hindsight, I go, God, that was so brave. And I mean,
yeah,
you know, I mean, neither one of us had a job, and I really didn't have any skills. I mean, not that many people were working with computers back then, but I certainly had zero computer skills, no typing skills whatsoever. I had learned nothing else, but I've always been teaching exercise classes. So that was my first direction, like just find exercise studios and teach aerobics. And
that is not what I thought you were going to say. I love it.
And you can't really make money with that. I mean, you ruin your body if you know, want to keep teaching so much aerobics that you can actually make a living.
Yeah,
with it.
Yeah.
You know, so I figured out, so I learned pretty quickly that wasn't going to be enough. So I had a job at a fashion store, and I was bored to tears there. And then I tried to find work as a florist, and then I ended up with my most sort of real decent job was that I worked as a physical therapy aide.
Ah.
I hated every minute of it. And that actually also made it really clear that that I, you know, really should be doing art. And
yeah.
So I kind of looked around for some galleries, and then there was this woman who was doing a little exhibit in this little shop type thing, and she just showed my work there, and she was totally weird. I don't know what was going on at the night of the opening, but she kind of just sat in the corner and sulked.
but
the great thing was that my future gallerist came by, and she loved the work, and she said, bring your stuff by, I want to see your work. And within a week, I was with that gallery and had a show scheduled and worked toward the show. And then I think shortly after that, I was able, I mean, it didn't take very long, then I was able to quit all the pesky jobs, or partly too, I would get let go because I wasn't a good fit. and I was just teaching a few exercise classes in the mornings, which was super fun. I ended up just not doing the aerobics thing too much longer, but taught like conditioning and water aerobics, and had like a group of elderly people. And then I did, and then later on, a few years down the road, I started teaching yoga, which that you can definitely teach every day. You know, that's not as involved physically as, I mean, in a certain way as aerobics is, you know, where you have to be kind of the cheerleader.
Yeah.
You can't just stand by the side and clap your hands and go, all right, everybody. You move while I stand here and clap my hands. You have to be like the Jane Fonda from beginning to end, you know.
Well, do you still teach yoga?
No, I don't anymore. I taught my last class just before I gave birth, and then I tried teaching again, and I was like, I'm still so busy mothering, and I'm so busy just with work that I just didn't go back to that. I started teaching art classes a little bit here and there, like workshops, and I haven't really taught in quite a while. The last workshop, a woman in my class broke both her elbows, and I was just kind of, or her forearms, and I was just, it was just such a stressful encounter or situation, I would say. It was nobody's fault. She just stumbled backwards, but it was right in front of my eyes, and the EMTs couldn't find the address, and she was kind of going into shock, and there was really nobody that like sat with me and her, and so it was kind of like, man, I need a break from teaching. And I also felt a little bit like I didn't want to keep teaching this format. It was very deep inquiry based into a person's kind of psyche in a way. And it often attracted people who really needed a therapist and not, you know, who just needed more than just like an inquiry to their art making, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And it just sometimes just felt too heavy.
Yeah. But, well, that's a lot because you were a mom already, right?
Yeah.
It's a lot when you're an artist yourself and a mother, because, you know, being a mom takes up so much of that giving, right? That it is, it is tricky. Mm-hmm. And so now are you just full-time art?
I'm doing full-time art, but I just put together a syllabus for a new workshop that I'll be teaching, which is kind of more of almost a retreat.
Oh.
And I don't have like a big mailing list, so mostly my friends are taking it, which is adorable. I feel so honored by them going, yeah, I really want to take it. I'm like, aw. But it's called Shamanism, Creativity, and Rewilding.
Ooh.
It's basically a connecting of all the things that I've been incredibly interested in and have been pursuing. So the work of shamanic journeying will be our method of basically moving into deep imagery, into guidance and ways of how we want to be creative. Then we are going to have extended periods of drawing or whatever art making people will choose. You know, it's really totally up to them. They don't have to work two-dimensional. They could also just keep writing, or one of the women that is coming is mostly a clay artist. So I imagine she will bring some clay.
And when and where are you doing this? Can people still, because I bet people are going to want to sign up.
Absolutely. I would love it. The workshop is at the end of September. It's September 29th through October 1st, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Starts Friday evening and goes through Sunday afternoon. And it's at a beautiful little retreat place called Sacred Groves on Bainbridge Island, which is just outside of Seattle.
It's beautiful.
Like a half-hour ferry ride over there. And we have, you know, these beautiful different spaces that people can stay in. And then we're doing like an incredibly healthy diet. I've got really into sort of a gut healing diet, and I'm into, you know, just kind of exploring. I'm not foraging or wild foods per se, but just really kind of focusing on really good ingredients and, you know, just having like a really good stuff to eat, you know. So, you know, if people need to have their caffeine or whatever, they can bring it, certainly, but I also want them to try and do without. And we're going to go, jump into the Puget Sound for those that are really afraid of cold water. This is kind of like somewhat of an initiation in certain ways.
Oh my gosh, it sounds amazing.
So it'll have like, you know, a lot of quiet time, a lot of like really being in silence. We're going to be doing a very long, an extended sit in the woods that are part of this property. To just really kind of go within, connect with the trees. We will prepare for each of these things with shamanic journey work and other sort of creative exercises. So it's both, again, sort of an inquiry into the self and into like, who am I? What do I want to express? If I express, how do I want to say it? How can I get clarity around the things that I'm interested in expressing, you know?
Is that where your work right now is going?
I think my work has always expressed all those interests.
Yeah.
I had a big phase where I had all these paintings of girls with antlers on them and kind of dressed like shamans. So that was a couple of years ago. That was probably the most, you know, kind of visually direct in that way. I would say the work now always reflects what I do and what I think and what I dream, but it's never so literal, you know. It's not an illustration of that. It's kind of in a certain way, an enigma to myself. I never really talk directly about my work. I kind of always feel like I talk a little bit around the work.
Mm.
And sometimes I feel I get information about the work through either the questions I'm being asked, because just recently I gave an artist talk at my gallery in Portland, which is always illuminating for me too, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And also through... sometimes through what people see, and then I go, you know, I didn't even notice that, but you're so right, you know, because I think the work is appealing to a large number of people because it taps into the bigger unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And people recognize something in it that speaks to them, that speaks of their own yearning or loves or feelings, or, you know, some people just stay with sort of the superficial of it, but a lot of people really get into, you know, like they get it.
Yeah, I'm not surprised at all, because there's like a sort of a mystical quality to like the work from, say, 2016, 2017 with like a lot of the, you know, like the dresses that were white and sort of see-through.
Mm-hmm.
Feel like, you know, ghostly and like sort of like dreamlike, and mm-hmm. and now, you know, the latest body of work on your site, body of work, there's no bodies, it's mainly the faces, and then it's almost like abstracty, swirly, you know. And I just thought, isn't that interesting, because it was always your dresses that I was like instantly drawn to.
Yeah.
And then they're gone, and now it's like, but the faces are such a beautiful part of it too, but now I'm totally drawn to the abstract part.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah. And then now I've made sort of a swing around again. I don't know if you looked at I think it's on the website right now, is the first new pieces for my show in Nashville.
Yes.
Which are focused on animals and have sort of the bodies of the bodies are there. They're a little bit obscured and they're see-through, but they're actually like the real bodies in terms of there's no clothing on them. They're just sort of arms and legs and bellies. And,
yeah.
You know, I'm just plodding on. I can never stay with something if I feel like, oh, you know, once I feel like I've painted this out of me, you know, and when there's no more inquiry, and that actually, come to think of it, the new show is called Inquiry. It's not the most brilliant title, but I had to come up with one really quickly. But as I talk about it, it actually makes more sense. But that there's always a desire in me that I want to keep searching. I can't just stay stuck with something. I'm not satisfied unless I'm like probing and looking and aiming to express more deeply what I'm trying to say.
Evolution, you're evolving, like, and you can, and you really can see that. That's why I wanted to have you on, because it's so funny that you're like, I kind of talk around my art, and it's just like, no, tell me all the stuff. Tell me why you do it. Why are there squirrels? I want to know all this stuff, but I won't pressure you.
I wouldn't be able to tell you anyway.
No, I know. And you kind of had that, you know, you can feel that too, that it is pretty instinctual. I feel the same way about my art, is that I get to a certain point, and not that I'm bored so much, but yeah, I like that you said that you've just sort of painted it out of yourself. Like, it's time. Yeah. You just have to keep moving and looking, and that's what I think all creative people do. I wanted to talk to you about, well, two probably big life events, having your daughter, and how do you pronounce it? Fibromyalgia.
Yeah.
What was it? Was that a song? I just heard a song burst in.
That was my daughter. That's why I shut the door. She's in the shower singing away.
Oh, my God.
And I'm sure if I don't, I might have to jump off here in 10 minutes and go, turn off the shower. Get out of the shower.
Typical 14. Teen. Yeah. 14 and singing. Thank you.
She's showered every day now. So it's like, come on, girl. I mean, I just use the hose outside. You know, just hop. Is it as hot? It's probably hot.
Yes, it's so hot here. It's awful, but I can't wait for, I just said to my husband this morning, I can't wait to wear sweaters and boots.
Yeah.
I can't wait. And maybe like a fluffy scarf. I'm pretty pumped about that. But anyway, I digress. And so when you had your daughter, because I know that, like, you know, it's a big topic of conversation about, you know, can women artists be mothers too? Yada, yada. Which I, of course, say, yeah. But anyway, how did that feel when you had her? Did you feel like, did you take a pause for a little bit from your work? Or was she in a sling and with you and you just kept working? Or how did that all go down?
I would say I did my worst work when I was pregnant. And that work is well hidden and nobody will get to see it. I think I was too busy creating something inside of me to come up with something intelligent. But then after she was born, it was funny. My mom was here for 6 weeks and she really pushed me, like, get back in the studio. And I was like, I'm not ready. Plus I had a C-section. So I felt doubly worse, you know.
Me too. I had one too. I know. Yes. It's not good.
Deprivation and opiates and whatnot, you know, like not a good combo. But eventually I got back in and basically I figured that I needed nannies really quickly, you know, because I needed someone to be with Ava. I couldn't paint with her on me. And she was also a very demanding kid who really wanted entertainment and eye contact. I couldn't just, like, put her in a corner and with a toy or something.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like some babies are much more self-sufficient, but she wasn't one of them. and so I had, you know, usually somebody who would come by for 2 or 3 hours. And then very shortly after Ava was born, I think within 6 months, my husband lost his job and figured that he really wanted to go back to school. And he had a really good program that was aimed at professionals. And so it was either on the weekend or it was like a week once a month. But the rest of the time, he was at home. And at that time, we really had more money than we have now. So back then, it was like no problem that I would pay for everything. And he was at home and went to school. And so he took care of Ava a lot then. And we just really shared the parenting job, which made a huge difference. And and then it was really good to have nannies because we didn't, neither one of us has family here. And I think it's really good when children are raised by several people and have other people sing to them and read to them and have different voices and different little clapping songs. And, you know, we're not meant to be raised in a nuclear family. So I was glad that I had two or three different people who came and entertained her and took her for a walk and took her to the zoo or whatever. And, of course, as she got older, it was, you know, then it gets even easier. Yeah. And I had her in a preschool at, I think she was almost three, but not quite, not quite out of her diapers yet. And she went to a really wonderful Montessori school, and she's always been a super outgoing kid. So it wasn't, you know, as long as the sitters were good. I was just telling her yesterday that she was very discerning. And if these women were not, you know, self-secure and had, you know, were emotionally healthy, if they weren't, she would just come to my studio door and she wouldn't leave me alone. She would not want to be with women that she could sense, like, had issues. It was really interesting. And we would sometimes not find out till later, till that.
Wow.
That two of them were abused, you know, by their boyfriends. And,
wow. Instincts of a little.
A little kid. You know, she's like, no, I did. That woman scares me. I don't want to be with her. I mean, she couldn't say that, but she would just, you know, that was always the test. If she had fun with the sitters, I could be in the studio. If the sitters were no good, she'd be at the studio door.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
That person's a no-go.
Yeah.
So that's how I made it happen. And I've always been a person that is very disciplined. I always do work before fun. A little bit of a workaholic, and I also am not waiting for the muse to hit or for the mood to strike. If I just know I got to go in and work, and whether I want to or not, whether I feel inspired, and especially when the weather is this nice in the summer, I'm like, I really want to sit outside and read a good book.
Yeah.
But I just do my hours in the studio no matter what. Same with, you know, with the fibromyalgia, I often don't feel good. But in some ways, the work is a distraction. And even if I feel crappy, I'm like, well, I've got to do my work. I got to just go in there and do it because lying on the couch isn't going to help me.
Yeah. And do you find that you get into a bit of a meditative state when you're working? Are you able to kind of forget the pain or no?
I wouldn't say I forget it. I'll feel basically my fibromyalgia, because I think people have different ways of how this illness feels to them, and I think fibromyalgia is a little bit of a mystery illness that has simply to do with a weird pain response, you know. Yeah. Since mine feels basically like I have the flu. I feel achy and I feel like I don't have much strength. You know, just like you feel when you have a flu, you're just kind of like, ugh, I just feel like I'm schlepping myself around, and I feel achy, and sometimes I have, you know, lung pain and things like that, or a sore throat. And so I'm still working on, you know, figuring out how to combat it, because I'm thinking more and more it has something to do with a retrovirus or some immune issue. And, you know, I just have not given up trying to make better, you know, choices food-wise and exercise-wise, and just keep looking to get better. And I think, I mean, compared to some people, I think I'm pretty lucky. I mean, in between, I feel very good and I'm not always in pain, and, you know, I can do stuff. So it's just sometimes, you know, like I want to go to my dance class, but then I'm like, you know, I just don't feel strong enough. I can't go, you know. Or sometimes I want to plan something that's like, you know, I feel really crappy. I can't do it. I have to say no. Or I know that in a day I can really only make time for like one, you know, outing in the city where I have to like run errands or whatever. And then it's like, I I would not want to also have like an afternoon engagement of some sort. You know, I just really have to pace myself. So, but where were we going with this? We're talking about being a mom and being an artist. So
I just thought like those are both things that I think people could use as an excuse to just not make work. You know, it's just like, well, I'm a mom now. I can't make work. I don't have time. And of course, you know, if you prioritize and you figure it out, of course you can do it. And I think mothers can be artists. And then like with a fibromyalgia, that thing you've got.
Yeah.
You know, that would be a really good excuse to quit too.
Mm-hmm.
And I really love when I read that about you, I thought, oh, I already admired your work so much. And you're obviously very prolific. Like you've always are having shows and there's new work being produced all the time. And when I read that, because my cousin has it and I know how debilitating it can be. And I have really bad arthritis. And so, you know, I get the pain thing. And I just, when I read that about you, it made me admire you even more that, you know, you keep going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always come across to people that I'm really energetic. They're usually surprised, you know, that I have fibromyalgia, and I am still very energetic in so many ways. But I also sometimes, like anybody with pain, you probably do this too, is you just kind of mask it, or you don't let it get the better of you, because what can you do about it? You know, you can't do anything about it. So you might as well. And often it feels better when I get into action, or I get under, you know, I hang out with people, and like this evening we're going to have like a spontaneous potluck, and I was just thinking, oh, my lung's really hurting. It's not going to be fun to be talking and stuff. But then I thought, oh, but it'll be so fun to just see my friends and spend like one of the last nice summer nights
I know, that's why I was wondering if it's a bit distracting, because I find when I get into the studio or I run, and I find that when I'm doing stuff like that I forget a little bit, and it's just kind of a good way, and I don't want to feel sorry for myself, you know. I want to just like keep going and do the things I want to do. But anyway, I just really wanted to bring that up because I was shocked to find that out, and I just think I just think it's inspiring that, you know, so if anybody's listening and they've got something that they're thinking, oh, I just won't make art today, or oh, then they can think of you.
Yeah, I hope. I mean, just different, you know, we never know what another person's pain feels debilitating it can be for some people. And so I have a lot of friends in my circle, and they are all actually tend to be women that are very intense and work intensely, and you know, are, you know, that actually sometimes have to be told like, slow down, you know, don't work quite as hard, don't do so much. And
it's learning to say no, you know. And I think when you're younger you don't ever say no, and as soon as you get a little bit older you're like, you know what, I don't want to go to this thing, or
exactly, you're so right, you know. It's like, this is just going to tucker me out. And
that, you know what, if I do errands in the morning, that means I'm not going to book an afternoon full of stuff. And instead of feeling guilty that you didn't book an afternoon full of stuff, you're like, cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And cutting yourself that slack, I think, is so important. Okay, I'm going to ask, because I know you're going to have to go and yell and turn the shower off.
Actually, the shower went off by itself. I'm really happy.
That's good.
I know.
Well, I have one more question before we do the not-so-speedy speed round. So we know that your amazing workshop is coming up end of September. What else is going on for you right now with shows? Because, you know, are there things people can go and see coming up, or are you working on stuff?
So what I just want to add to the workshop is that it's dirt cheap. It's going to be $400. It really basically means I'm not getting paid, but it's totally worth it for me, because I feel like I'm birthing a new workshop. And as I get older, I really want to be more of a mentor, and I want to, you know, teach people the things that I'm excited about and help them with their creative expression, and they're finding their way to nature and their interconnectedness to everything. And those are just things that are so close to my heart that I you know, want to teach this workshop and let people have this experience. And then for me, it's a way to see like, what can I improve, or what can I change and get more experience in doing these sorts of retreats. Otherwise, I'm really working on my Nashville show, and I'm not sitting here making a dream catcher. It sounds so corny. We used to always make my husband said, remember not too long ago you were just making fun of dream catchers? And I'm like, yeah, because they're hanging on rear view mirrors when they should be hanging in your bedroom to catch your bad dreams.
That's right.
So then after Nashville, I have a show in Seattle with my new gallery that I've started showing with called Patricia Rouser Gallery. Mm. That will be a solo show there. And after that, I have another show with the same gallery that my Nashville show is with, which is David Lusk in Memphis. And I've been with them for many, many years, and they're just an amazing gallery.
I see their name come up all the time.
David is such a wonderful gallerist, and he just does a fabulous job of supporting his artists. He's incredible.
That is so good to hear, because you can hear the opposite.
Oh, I've had mostly just wonderful luck with my galleries. Yeah. I mean, there's very few where I'm like, you know, I'm disappointed, but he's one of the absolute amazing galleries that I show with, and there are so many other great ones too. I've been with him probably almost the longest of all my galleries, other than my first Seattle gallery that unfortunately closed a few years ago.
Well, I'll put all of these dates. I do a great big post with every podcast so that people can see the art that we were talking about. And I'll put all of the workshop info and all of the dates for the shows at the bottom so people can go and find you.
Super. That's great.
Okay,
and be sure that my most up-to-date stuff is always on Instagram. So that's been kind of my absolute, like, go-to place, and that's been a place where I've met a lot of wonderful people that I've done art trades with, and you know, meeting them and doing things with them, and it's been just lovely.
Isn't it great? It's so immediate, and you have access to the entire world, like at the tip of your fingers, and you don't have to update your site.
It's really great.
It is. Well, I'll put your handle in there too so they can find you. And okay, now ready for the not so speedy speed round?
Yes, go for it.
Okay, this, I kind of actually know the answer to this, but I had to throw it in. Would you ever pierce anything?
Of my body?
Yeah.
I just had my nose pierced.
I know. And you know how I know that? I saw it on Instagram.
Oh, okay.
And so I thought, I got to throw that in.
I was like, this is too coincidental.
That was my tiny bit of research. So you and your daughter got matching nose rings.
Yes.
That's so cool.
It was very cute.
Whose idea was that?
It was sort of both of our idea. I can't remember if her or I came up with it. I think it was pretty like both at the same time. Hey, Ava.
Yeah?
Do you remember whose idea it was with the nose piercing?
Mine?
She said it was hers.
It was most definitely mine.
Whatever.
I was like, Mom, I'm going to have a nose piercing. She's like, let's do it together. And I was like, okay.
Because then she knew she could get one.
Yep, exactly.
And I had one years ago. I was living in London and I got one. It hurt so much. Did it hurt you?
It hurt like hell.
I know, the whole side of my face felt like I'd been punched in the head.
Yep, it was pretty nasty, but it's really good now.
But it looks just cool, so.
It didn't take long at all to kind of stop hurting as long as I'm not picking my nose.
Yeah, don't pick your nose, and do not try changing it anytime soon. I changed it really fast.
Ooh,
don't do that. Please don't do that.
I don't even think I'll change it really ever.
Mine was so long ago that it was back in the days where they'd put the big giant stud in, and then you were supposed to leave it for 2 weeks and then change it to your pretty little diamond.
Oh, my God. Oh, no.
And it was so embarrassing. I was 21 or something with this giant stud, and I was like, this is so not cute. And so I took it out and put the diamond in, and it hurt more than getting it pierced.
Oh, I can just imagine.
I just about passed out from the pain. And so leave it where it is.
Yeah.
Trust me. Okay,
and
see,
that's it for piercings too. I'm not planning on any others.
No, that's it for now. Until Ava wants something else done.
She wants other stuff. I'm like, yep, when you're 18.
Yeah.
I mean, almost rather that than tattoos.
I was going to say so mother-daughter.
So sick and tired of those, you know.
Mother-daughter tattoos at 18.
Yeah.
You see, this is why it's the not-so-speedy speed round.
Yep, I get it. Yeah. Next question.
Okay, next question. Do you believe in ghosts?
I don't.
Oh.
Not in the term of ghosts. I believe in energies is probably the best way to describe it, because I don't even want to call it spirits, although I do think there is something that I would call an animal spirit that's like a spirit helper or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also don't feel that this is something very realistic or concrete. I think it's more tapping again into an energy that exists out there that holds the energy of, say, of that sad animal. Or there's something to the human psyche that when we connect into what we think is that animal's energy, there's something inside of us, simply even just because of our DNA and how we evolved from mammals to apes to etc., is that there is, that's probably not a great way to word it, excuse me everybody, I sometimes so hard to describe these things.
No, I know what you mean, yeah.
But that there is that there is this web that we're all connected, and I find that sort of this shamanic work is just a wonderful way of tapping into it without needing anybody's permission or description or way of doing it. There's, you know, like I do it in a very non-culturated way, meaning everybody has shamanic journeying in their DNA, and there's a very straightforward, basically, sort of framework to how you do it, and whatever other ritual people like to use, or some people like to follow the, you know, Lakota way, or the way of the people in Hawaii, or the Siberian shamans. I wouldn't even know the first thing about it, and I don't need to. I just do a straightforward, you know, rhythm-based journey, and if people want to do something ritualistic around it, that's great. I have no problems with that, but I don't need to copy or do something that someone else does.
Mm-hmm.
So my understanding of these things that I see is, in so many ways, just deeper moving into the psyche and into the realm of what's the unseen, which mm-hmm. is such a broad spectrum. But the sort of idea of what I think people think of ghosts, I don't believe in that at all.
See, I had to ask, because I always find, like, your dresses, those dresses always freaked me out in a... like in a good way, like in a give you chills kind of way, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there is, and all of that, like, while you were talking, I got chills again, because there's just, I totally agree with you. There's something else. This can't be it. Mm-hmm. Let's really hope this is not it.
Yeah.
There has to be more. And so I was saying to my husband, okay, give me speed round. And he's like, you got to ask her if she believes in ghosts. And I'm like, okay, so there we go. Okay, and then last one, your favorite animal and your favorite animal to paint, in case it's a different animal.
Well, I would say probably my favorite animal, it's so tough, between dogs and birds, I don't know. You know, dog being like my favorite pet.
Right.
And my favorite animal is probably any kinds of birds, especially those that are just fluttering around our garden that I get to watch and get to be so amazed at whatever they're doing. You know, it's just so incredible. Painting-wise, I don't like painting birds actually that much. They're tedious. I like anything furry because it's so much fun to paint fur.
Yeah.
I think I'm without being a show off, I think I'm really good at rabbits. So I would say rabbits.
You are because, really good at rabbits.
Because the other ones are definitely, the faces are so hard to get off, whether it's a deer or a bear, or it's just hard. I find it's much more challenging. And I somehow, the rabbit, I've painted so many that always helps practice. Hello.
Yeah.
But I just love painting them, and they're lovely. And I try never to paint like bunnies, but more like really, you know, those amazing hares that are large and strong. And it's actually the women that are having all these boxing matches, and it's just so fascinating. So. Or the female hares, I believe, are.
Well, I'm very glad that that was your answer, because now I have an excuse in the post to put a whole bunch of your rabbit paintings.
Yay! Great.
And that's it. That's all my stuff.
Well, thank you so much for making the time to speak to me and
thank you. What was your potluck tonight? And all, you even took an hour to talk to me.
Oh, yeah, I'm not going to like... This is going to be an easy potluck.
No,
whatever we have in the fridge.
It was so nice because, you know, I have loved your work for so long, and I felt a tiny bit intimidated to reach out to you because you're a big fancy deal. And it's just so nice to know that you've got a daughter who's taking showers for too long, and you're working on Dreamweavers and, or not Dreamweavers, Dreamcatchers. And it's just... it's so nice to hear your story, and it makes your work that much more chilled inducing. So I can't wait to put the post together and so that everybody see everything.
Thank you. And be sure to send me the connection to the podcast.
Oh, so I will. I will for sure.
Great. Well,
thank you so much, and enjoy the last little bit of summer, and hopefully the smoke will clear and we can wear our sweaters and boots soon.
I know. And that everybody... care for the environment and not chop so much, because all these burning woods have to do with climate change. And I just pray that we all find ways to do our part. It's so important. Like just today, my daughter wanted to go shopping back to school, and I said, let's go to the place where they recycle first, you know? And we went, and we got like almost everything for nothing. And it's all used pens and use binders, and you know, we don't have to buy it all new.
Absolutely.
So that's my little shout out there to everyone who loves my work but also feels connected to the environment, because it's, you know, it's so crucial. So
it is, it's hugely important. That's a perfect way to,
all right,
to end
segue.
It.
Thank you
perfect.
So much.
Thank you, Anne, and I will talk to you soon.
Okay, take care.
You too. Bye. Isn't she fantastic? Not only is her work full of mystery and magic, so is Anne. If you get a chance to see her work in person, take it. And if you're up for a little creativity, shamanism, and rewilding, I believe there are still 2 spots in her upcoming workshop. I'm going to put a link in the post on my site, thejealouscurator.com, so that you can go and check out that workshop. Thank you so much to Anne for hanging out with us for an hour. And thanks to Saatchi Art for continuing to support Art for Your Ear. And of course, thank you so much for coming back for season 2. There will be more Art for Your Ear next weekend. See you then.